This is a special audio presentation covering recent U.S. military actions in the Middle East in prophetic perspective. And now, Garner Ted Armstrong.
For decades, I have said, watch the Middle East. I have said, focus in on Jerusalem and Israel, because the Bible is a Middle Eastern book. For decades, in writing dozens of articles, many, many booklets, in doing dozens, if not hundreds, of television programs and radio programs on the subject of Bible prophecy, I've continually talked about the most volatile region in the world, the Middle East, the Arab countries surrounding the State of Israel. Why? Well, because the Bible is a Middle Eastern book, because Jesus Christ was born in the Middle East, in Bethlehem, right near Jerusalem, because Jesus began his ministry up near Galilee, because the famous Olivet prophecy was made from the Mount of Olives, opposite one of the most famous skylines in all the world today, the city of Jerusalem, and because Jesus Christ suffered, bled, and died, and was resurrected in Jerusalem. And because the Bible itself, in some of the major prophecies of Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, especially Daniel, the 7th chapter, the 11th, the 12th chapter, and the most pivotal prophecies of all the Bible, Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21, the famous Olivet prophecies of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, look at Jerusalem, Palestine, and the Middle East, and then at all of the geopolitical trends and conditions that would eventually usher in what Christ called the time of the Great Tribulation, the heavenly signs, and the day of the Lord. So now, once again, the most volatile region in the world erupts in flame. Saddam Hussein sends several divisions of soldiers with many tanks and artillery pieces into Kurdish territory in northern Iraq at the invitation of one of the warring Kurdish factions. And the United States retaliates with cruise missile attacks against Iraqi targets in southern Iraq, and as you know, long since, has extended the no-fly zone almost to the suburbs of Baghdad. There are all sorts of analyses, literally by the dozens and the hundreds that I have watched on CNN and the major news networks from that time. Not to agree with the Russian foreign minister or with the Iraqi government itself or with specialists who are analyzing the Iraqi response on British television. Let me at least put this in some sort of perspective. After all, this was in Iraq where this took place. It was in the Kurdish part of Iraq, near the border with Turkey, where the Kurds actually spill over into three countries, Turkey, Iran, and Iraq. Two warring, competing Kurdish factors, both of which would really like to rip Kurdistan or the Kurdish area of northern Iraq away from the control of Saddam Hussein, were themselves fighting. Suddenly it was revealed that one of the factions had received arms shipments, not tanks and heavy artillery necessarily, but significant arms shipments from Iran. Iran, of course, greatly feared by much of the world as an exporter of world terrorism. Greatly feared by Iraq because of an 8-year protracted war between the two, and even though there is an uneasy peace now, nothing was really settled. And certainly greatly feared by Saudi Arabia, which has about a 17-20% Shiite population in Saudi Arabia. You may remember the occupation, the big riots, and the occupation of Mecca some years ago. And you may also know that the bombings that have been carried out by terrorists inside Saudi Arabia aimed at wresting any kind of coalition, cooperation, or alliance between the United States and Saudi Arabia away from each other, trying to force the United States out of Saudi Arabia. Those bombings, those terrorist attacks have been carried out, and it is well known by the Saudis themselves, by the United States intelligence agencies, and indeed by the general public, because it's been reported on, that those were sponsored by Iranian Shiite Muslims. So when the Iranians shipped some arms to one of the two warring Kurdish factions, the other Kurdish faction, though it would really like independence from Saddam Hussein, invited Saddam Hussein into its territory. Here came Saddam with his tanks and artillery pieces into Erbil. That provided the reason, so it was stated, for our president to unilaterally without the support of most of the former coalition partners, send missile strikes not into northern Iraq, not against the Republican Guard or their tanks or artillery pieces somewhere outside Erbil, but into southern Iraq. Now, there's been a lot of speculation. I am not a politician. I remain apolitical, and I don't take part in the political process, nor do I sponsor or in any way try to support any political candidate. Suffice it to say that there are many people who immediately saw what happened in Iraq as a political ploy. The White House was just as quick to deny it. They saw it that way probably because of some of the parameters of the entire situation that I've just outlined, and probably you have long since heard over your own nightly television news and read in your local newspapers and or a major weekly news magazine. Whether or not this is so risky that it's going to result in a terrible problem for Mr. Bill Clinton's White House is yet to be seen, perhaps. And probably by the time you hear this tape, made just very shortly before you will see the television program announcing it, because of the volatility and the unpredictability of what happens in that region, any number of things could have gone on. Whether or not all the command and control centers and all of the anti-aircraft defense centers and the artillery centers and the radar emplacements and all that have been taken out by the cruise missiles remains to be seen. The point is that once having expanded the no-fly zone, that means that piloted American and perhaps British aircraft are going to be patrolling the skies over Iraq, very close to Baghdad. If one or more of them is shot down, and if we are treated to the beaten, bloodied, blackened face of an American pilot in Iraqi custody on the front cover of Time magazine, then I think all Americans know the kind of pressure that that will put on the current administration. It will be virtually unbearable. It's one thing to send in pilotless, unmanned missiles. It's quite another to send young American men and women into harm's way. We will have to see what is going to happen. This time, neither Turkey nor Saudi Arabia approved of the attacks, nor will they allow U.S. aircraft to operate from their territories. And with the exception of Britain and a little bit of at least lip service from Germany, none of the former coalition allies backed the American attacks. So what's going to happen next? Will these events and growing Arab anger over Israel's new prime minister's policies toward the Palestinians lead to another major war in the Middle East? By the time you hear this taped broadcast, this lecture or study into the situation in the light of recent history and Bible prophecy, a meeting will have taken place, at least it's been announced, unless it falls through, between Yasser Arafat and Benjamin Netanyahu. We don't know what is going to come out of that. To go back and to set this up and to put you in the picture a little bit, when Arab terrorists drove a big tanker truck up to the barricades outside an American troop barracks in Dhahran, in Saudi Arabia, and blew the building apart with an estimated 5,000 pounds of explosives, the shockwaves reached Europe and Japan, as well as the United States, who mourned 19 Air Force personnel killed and hundreds injured. That bombing of those barracks in Saudi Arabia came in the immediate aftermath of elections in Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu narrowly defeated Shimon Peres, the successor to slain Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. Rabin had been the architect of the peace process in the Middle East. He had granted major concessions to the Palestinians. He had effected a treaty with Jordan. He was offering to negotiate with Syria over the Golan Heights and along Israel's northeastern border with Syria. He was agreeing to halt the expansion of the settlements in the West Bank. Had in fact halted some of them, had in fact caused some, not many, to literally be abandoned. And all of that was changed because the entire platform upon which Benjamin Netanyahu ran was to completely overthrow every one of those things and go back to what is called a status quo ante, meaning the time before Yitzhak Rabin had become the prime minister and had begun the peace process. Now, will all of these terrorist bombings in Saudi Arabia, these attacks in Iraq, and all of the upset all around the world, the skyrocketing oil prices as a result, and other recent events in the Middle East, lead toward the building of the Third Temple and the setting up of what is called the Abomination of Desolation. Jesus Christ said, and I quote in Matthew 24 and in verse 15, "When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place." Matthew then adds parenthetically, "Whoso readeth, let him understand." He says then, "Let them which be in Judea." Judea was the Romish province that included Jerusalem and its environs. "Flee into the mountains," and that can be northeast, west, or south, because it's in a mountainous area, as you may know, up above the Maritime Plain, high in the mountains between the Mediterranean and the Dead Sea. And it says, "Let those that are on the housetop not come down to take anything out of their homes. Let those that are in the field at work not come back into their homes." It says, "Pray that your flight be not in the winter or on the Sabbath day." And he goes on to say, "For then," when you see something called the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, he says, "then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be." Paraphrased, a time of great trouble, a time of great chaos, of great destruction, obviously a time of great warfare, because he had said, "You will see nation rising against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in diverse places." To really understand and to get a full grasp of the entire background of this prophecy, of everything that Jesus said about drought and famine, about the spread of all kinds of diseases, you need to get one of our very newest booklets that I've talked about recently, as well as the one that I advertised. If you didn't receive it when this tape came, be sure to ask for it, the brand new booklet called The Great Tribulation, Is It About to Happen? The Great Tribulation that Jesus Christ spoke of is a time of world trouble, of massive warfare, and it means the introduction of chemical, biological, and very likely nuclear weapons into what will widen into a global World War III. There's simply no question about it from the pages of the prophecies of the book of Daniel, of Jesus Christ's Olivet prophecy, and the prophecies in the book of Revelation. Now, will these recent events lead toward the building of the Third Temple? I'm going to save the answer for that a little later, because that is dealt with very much in that booklet, The Great Tribulation. And also, we have another brochure you can have if you want it, called Will a Temple Soon Be Built in Jerusalem? All you've got to do is to call 903-825-2525 or write to us, Garner Ted Armstrong, Box 2525 in Tyler, Texas, and the zip code is 75710. And you can have that brochure, Will a Temple Soon Be Built in Jerusalem? Now remember, a major indication from Christ himself that the Great Tribulation was about to begin is also covered in Luke 21, when he said, "You shall see armies surrounding Jerusalem." What is religious about armies surrounding Jerusalem? I've asked that question for a purpose. Because the minute you talk about the Bible, about Jesus Christ, and about prophecy, many people will simply tune you out. They don't want to hear about it. They don't want to know or believe or understand that there is a step-by-step sequence of events that have been predicted by Jesus Christ of Nazareth himself and by major biblical prophecies, because they've heard so many weird scenarios. They've heard so many scare stories. They've heard so many weird things that sounded like somebody got it out of a little felt bag of frog's knuckles and bat's wings, or tarot cards, or a crystal ball, or out of his own demented mind. And there are so many things that people have predicted that are supposed to take place, and oftentimes they don't, like those that have written books about the rapture, like Jim Jones and the group of people, tragically, that followed him to the jungles of Guyana so many years ago, like people in Switzerland and Canada that have made suicide pacts and thought the end was near, so let's go ahead and do ourselves in. There have been so many weird scenarios presented by so many false teachers that it's a wonder anyone is willing to listen to any scenario about biblical prophecy. My name is not Chicken Little. I'm not saying the sky is falling, the sky is falling. I'm not saying there is anything at all that you, as a private citizen in the United States or Canada or Britain or South Africa or wherever this tape goes, can do anything about what is happening in Iraq or Jerusalem between Israel and the Palestinian Arabs or anywhere else in the world. All of us feel utterly helpless oftentimes because we are like spectators on the world scene, and the major news media come on stage and they say, look, look over here in the wings to the right. Oh, now look up here. Now look over there. Our attention is swept back and forth here and there on the world scene by events over which we have no control. Now, the reason why I said there is nothing religious about armies surrounding Jerusalem is to make the point that Jesus Christ of Nazareth, in the Olivet Prophecy, was talking about what we should describe as geopolitical events, military events, and some of them natural events, so-called, because he talked about droughts and famines and pestilences and disease epidemics and earthquakes in diverse places. But these are the signs of the times. These are the very things Jesus Christ said his people are to watch. Why? So they would be ready spiritually. So they would be ready doing his work, helping others, warning, witnessing to others. I remind you of the young sergeant atop the building when the big oil tanker pulled up down in Saudi Arabia. He saw those people furtively park that big tanker truck. He saw them jump into a car and speed away. He ran from the rooftop where he was on guard, down into the first three stories he could reach, working his way from the top to the bottom of that big building. And he was screaming at the top of his lungs and banging on doors because many of the people were asleep and in casual undress and so on. And he was saying, bomb, bomb, get out, everybody. He was warning. He was desperately trying to save lives. Now, as a result, many, many were killed, and it went up into the hundreds that were killed and injured. And the pictures were horrifying. But this young man, a sergeant, as I recalled, had done everything he could do to warn other people. Why? Because his motives were to save lives, were to save them the shattering experience of having a leg blown off, to save them all the months in the hospital, to save people from being horribly maimed and cut and killed. Shocked and heartbroken families attended memorial services as bodies were returned home. You remember about that and how President Clinton attended two memorial services in Florida on the same day. And in the aftermath of that, Americans were incensed to learn that Saudi government had not been the docile, cooperative partner many had assumed. Not only had the Saudis refused to allow U.S. intelligence agents access to five terrorists who had exploded a bomb months earlier and were then beheaded, but the U.S. commander at the site of the Tehran bombing had been refused permission to place the concrete barriers any further away from the building. That blast focused attention on an alliance that has grown increasingly tenuous, if not sour. Saudi Arabia has been a pivotal ally for the United States in the Gulf, enormously important to Europe, Japan, and the U.S. because of its huge oil reserves. It's required the most delicate kind of diplomacy to preserve that relationship over the decades with one of the wealthiest and most strategically located Arab nations. Is all of that coming to an end? The Saudis flatly refused to become involved in America's cruise missile attack against Iran. So did, by the way, Egypt. So did Turkey. So did all of the other allies of the former coalition in the Gulf, with the exception of Great Britain and a little bit of lip service from Germany. So that forced us to send B-52 bombers from only about 100 miles from where I'm seated right now at Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana, all the way to Guam, and from there to load up and to go down to Diego Garcia, or to go directly from Guam and to launch cruise missiles in the air and return to their base half a world away. That required us to fire cruise missiles from surface vessels already on station in the Persian Gulf. We could not use Turkish air bases. We couldn't use Jordanian airfields, and we couldn't use Saudi Arabian air bases, even though we have a large number of F-15s, F-16s, and other aircraft on the ground in Saudi Arabia. That tells you something about just how strong is this alliance between the United States and some of these Islamic countries like Turkey and Saudi Arabia that are so incredibly important to us. Now, the new right-wing government in Israel is extremely important for us to understand of how this is going to play out and whether or not there is going to be a widening, massive war coming from quarters we may not expect, like Syria, like Egypt and Saudi Arabia, like maybe the creation of a new United Arab Republic with Hosni Mubarak being far more of a player on the world scene than we had ever expected, or Assad, and maybe in cooperation this time with some pretty far-out Arab states that sponsor terrorism like Libya and Iran. And, of course, a lot of people understand about Mr. Farrakhan going over to Libya recently and receiving a big check to help with his causes in the United States from Muammar Gaddafi. Well, the new right-wing government in Israel has once again renewed building Jewish settlements in the West Bank. It has not withdrawn Israeli armed forces from Hebron, has insisted Jerusalem will never again be a divided city, and has stated it won't allow a separate Palestinian state to be created within Israel. All four of these items were on the table, were being negotiated, and were the real principal showpieces of the entire peace process of trading land for peace started by Yitzhak Rabin. Now, the new government has balked on placing the return of the Golan Heights to Syria on the table, and Rabin was even beginning to discuss that. If a widening war comes in the Middle East, the world's great powers would be immediately drawn in. You see, that's another point I want to make. These things are not happening because there are verses in Matthew 24 and Luke 21 and in the book of Daniel, chapters 11 and 12 in the book of Revelation, that have to do with a coming Holocaust, a great World War III using chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. They're not going to happen because there is a chapter and a verse that says so. They're going to happen because of human governments, because of human corruption, human avarice and greed, because of human religious bigotry and hatred, because of ethnic and racist hatreds, because of age-old traditional religious bias and hatred, because right there in the Middle East is where, like a rushing tidal bore swirling around of absolute violence and chaos, the three great monotheistic religions come together, not usually peacefully, as we have seen over the centuries, dating all the way back to the domination of Jerusalem by Islamic forces, and all the way to the Seljuk Turks, and clear through the days of World War I, when Allenby finally wrested control on behalf of Britain and the Western Allies away from the Ottoman Turkish Empire, the days anciently of the Middle Ages of the Crusades, when nominal Christians sent armies into Jerusalem to battle with the Islamic forces of the Mohammedans or the Muslims. Let's get a little bit of background so we can understand. It was in the 1930s that American prospectors representing American oil companies created a sprawling complex in the desert that would eventually become Dahran. From that time on, Americans have lived and worked in the desert kingdom called Saudi Arabia. For decades, we have courted Saudi rulers, striving to maintain a delicate balance between U.S. support for Israel and growing U.S. dependency on Arab oil. In a recent article in U.S. News and World Report, Fawad Ajami wrote, and I quote, "It was on the back of a napkin, historians tell us, that Franklin Roosevelt established the claim to American primacy in Saudi Arabia. Persian oil is yours," FDR's scribble told Britain's ambassador. "We share the oil of Iraq and Kuwait. As for Saudi Arabian oil, it is ours." That is exactly what Franklin Roosevelt said to a British ambassador on a napkin. He wrote it down. It's been preserved. It's a matter of historical record. Great powers dividing up the spoils. Blunt words, but those were the spoils of war. British power in the Mideast had been unchallenged for decades, but now it was America's turn. From the time of the decline of the British Empire, American hegemony has been present in the Persian Gulf. The fall of the Shah of Iran, whose oppressive regime had been the darling of U.S. governments for many years, was one of the first major blows to American presence in the region. American companies had invested heavily in Iran. I knew personally a man who was over at one of the major construction, architectural and engineering design firms who went up there all the time, back and forth. About every time I would see him, he was on his way again to that area up in Iran. Major oil companies, engineering and architectural firms, businesses of every kind were involved. As attested to, by the way, in passing by the daring rescue of employees of Ross Perot, documented in his book Wings of Eagles, how he went up there to get some of his own men out when the Shah fell and when American hostages were taken. And who doesn't remember that? The Iran hostage situation during the Carter administration and the scandal that later on rocked the Reagan administration and brought down Oliver North. Once rabid Iranian Islamic fundamentalists had catapulted the Ayatollah Khomeini into power and the Shah had fled for his life, it was all over for the United States in Iran. And then came those infamous 8 years of the Iraq-Iran war. Now, if you think back, it was expedient for the United States and European countries to build up Saddam Hussein's infrastructure and the Iraqi economy and Saddam's growing war machine as an hedge against virulent Islamic fundamentalism and Iranian threats. U.S. companies, along with many from Germany, Britain, Switzerland, and other countries, sold billions of dollars of high-tech communications equipment, of weapons of all kinds, including chemicals to make chemical weapons, and actually the means to begin producing nuclear reactors and work on nuclear programs. They sold all of this to Iraq. And so, by the way, did Saudi Arabia. For 8 long years, the Saudis supported Saddam Hussein with lavish aid. It bought them nothing, because Saddam had obviously wanted to create chaos in Saudi Arabia and eventually take it over. And it wasn't only because he viewed it as a U.S. pawn, but he wanted to control the bulk of the world's oil supply. His invasion of Kuwait was seen as only a first phase toward taking control of Saudi Arabia. After massive loss of life and the wrecking of so many port facilities and oil-producing facilities and waging war back and forth and incredible loss of civilian life, the Iraq-Iran war ground to an indecisive halt. Iran had not won, and if it wasn't quite a win for Iraq, it was stalemate for the present, and the United States could heave a sigh of relief that the fanatic Shiite fundamentalist revolution seemed contained a little bit. And that's the entire policy today in the Gulf, in the Middle East, that used to be the failed policy of the United States in Southeast Asia. They thought about a domino theory. They thought about the containment of communism. And now it is the containment of these gangster states that we are really interested in. I say we, meaning the United States government. They want to contain Iran. They want to contain Saddam Hussein. They don't want adventurism, hegemony, expanding warfare and upset and chaos because of the flow of oil. U.S. support for the Saudi family, commencing with King Ibn Saud in the late 1940s, was always a calculated risk. Moderate Arab governments have always been courted by Western powers for obvious reasons. For many years, the United States sold ever more sophisticated arms to Saudi Arabia, allegedly always for purely defensive purposes, of course. And it helped offset Israeli outrage by sending U.S. aid and arms and so on to Israel at the same time. Now, U.S. influence in the Gulf may have really been dealt a nearly fatal blow. There's been growing popular dissent in Saudi Arabia, and much of that has been absent from the Western media, so you haven't heard a lot about it. But massive demonstrations have taken place in Riyadh. Growing segments of the population are disgusted with the corrupt Saudi ruling family. The family itself is in disarray. There is growing competition between two of the family who hope to succeed ailing King Fahd ibn Abdul Aziz, and Fahd's half-brother, Crown Prince Abdullah, is pitted against Prince Sultan, who is defense minister, and the old king's full brother. Only a very few months ago, when Fahd was very sick, Crown Prince Abdullah was acting king. And listen to this, because this will send chills up and down your back. It certainly did in Western intelligence agencies, and it did, I'm sure, in the Pentagon and the Situation Room in the White House. Because in the immediate aftermath of the bombing in Tehran, Prince Abdullah called a special summit. And it wasn't covered very much. Oh, there was a little bit here and there, but most people didn't even hear about it in the Western media. He went to Damascus to see Syrian President Hafez Assad, and he asked Mubarak of Egypt to join them. And that was unusual. That was really different. Assad was an Air Force general who seized power in a coup back in 1970. Many of the Arab leaders see themselves as the major player among all other Arab states, and many wish to see themselves at the head of an Arab Union of some kind. Assad is no exception. And that hasty summit was not merely a photo op. Summits are at all levels, from economic, military, intelligence, all the way up to the heads of state and their aides. And summits go on in many different rooms, in different buildings, behind many closed doors. And what comes out of summits are not people posing for pictures, but sometimes deals that are going to really affect the rest of the world for a long time to come. That hasty summit no doubt sent chills through many Western intelligence agencies because it appeared as if Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Syria were attempting to revive a kind of a UAR, or United Arab Republic, the former brainchild of Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt back in the 1960s. And all of that had to do with an Arab coalition, with Arab unity against and around Israel. It had to do with a direct threat toward the survival of the state of Israel. That emergency meeting must have been particularly ominous to Israel and the United States, because, of course, Egypt signed the Camp David Accords, and both Egypt and Saudi Arabia have been looked upon as moderate Arab governments, and neither has done anything to really sully Israel's rapprochement with them previously or to try to drive a wedge between the United States and Israel. So with those three getting together, that is ominous. And we won't know for some time what was talked about privately, but probably eventually some of it will come out. Since the Carter administration, Egypt has continued to fulfill its obligations under the Camp David Accords and has maintained a kind of an uneasy peace with Israel. But Assad sees himself as the victim of a conspiracy by Turkey, Israel, and Jordan. Let me explain. He sees himself surrounded by hypocritical Islamic forces. You see, Turkey has a treaty with Israel by which it allows Israeli aircraft to use Turkish airspace, and that drives Hafez Assad crazy. It makes him blind, raging mad. Not only this, but as I say in my book that I hope you will read on the Great Tribulation, there are those who say the next major wars in this world are going to come in fights over water resources, over aquifers, rivers, and over dams, and the availability of unpolluted water for drinking and for human use. So Turkey is planning to build a 22-dam complex along the upper Euphrates River that supplies water to Syria and Iraq. And that's got both Syria and Iraq extremely upset, because you're talking about impounding in 22 dams the headwaters of major rivers that they both depend upon for water supply. Millions of Americans now know that the United States military was very unhappy with the lack of cooperation from the Saudi Arabians involved in security at their compound in Dahran. Many television news reports have explained how the United States investigative agencies, including the FBI, were really frustrated when they were denied access to the terrorists who had earlier set off a bomb in November of 1995 outside a military complex in Riyadh. And that was aimed at Americans who had been training, by the way, the Saudi National Guard. Four Americans were killed, a number of others injured. The Saudis kept it from us and the FBI. They tried the bombers and then promptly beheaded them. Since the Dahran bombing, strident voices of criticism have been heard from within the military and the Pentagon and the government of the United States concerning lack of Saudi cooperation, and it's really strained the relationships. So it was no accident that those November bombers chose the site they did, because the Saudi National Guard has as its primary objective the protection of the Saudi royal family, which has an estimated 4,000 princes. And for decades, it's been common gossip that Saudi Arabian princes, with their many private intercontinental jets and their huge fortunes, have dropped millions of dollars in American and other gambling casinos around the world. They are notorious for it. To the Islamic fundamentalists, such behavior is completely corrupt. They resent American presence. They resent American television, American entertainment, and American culture. Any American who has been over there and has rushed like mad when some kind of an alert came out into the desert to throw away his booze can tell you exactly what I'm talking about. because they live in an Islamic fundamentalist community where there is such vast disparity between Western dress, Western culture, Western eating habits, and Western way of living and the Islamic fundamentalists that there's simply no comparison. And, of course, they call the United States the Great Satan and Israel the Little Satan. Now, to them, to these fundamentalists, the Saudi family has been completely corrupted by the United States, the Great Satan. And that recent bombing may only be the beginning, but it certainly was an attempt to drive the United States out of Saudi Arabia, just like the bringing down of the barracks in Lebanon that killed so many Marines drove the United States out of Lebanon many years earlier. Now, the Saudi National Guard, as a result of that, is being expanded by some 22,000 men and being provided with heavier weapons. So, like feudal lords of old, the princes of the Saudi family are seen surrounding themselves with elite guards, just like Saddam Hussein has done with his Republican guards, because dictators need to have guards around them. The Washington Times reported that a purchase package of some $3.4 billion had been allotted to the Saudi National Guard for purchasing about 1,000 Canadian-built armored vehicles, TOW anti-tank launchers, and 155mm howitzers. That's heavy weaponry for a kind of a palace guard. And that's a sign of growing popular dissent, because the country is beginning to become very restive about these moves. There are many, many segments of the population in Saudi Arabia that don't like the current government and certainly hate the United States and Israel. And the dissenters include infiltrators from Iran and Iraq who are trying to heat the whole thing up. And though United States forces have been placed on much more intensive security alert, many of them moved way out further into the desert, no one believes that the massive bomb that was exploded in Tehran is the last terrorist attack against U.S. forces there. And the last thing the United States wants is the overthrow of the Saudi regime. Yet, with Iranian and Iraqi infiltrators, along with plenty of homegrown Islamic fundamentalists who have coalesced into various terrorist groups, and there are many, the odds are against any kind of long-term tranquility in Saudi Arabia, source of a tremendous percentage of the world's oil supplies, and that affects Japan and Europe. Japan is 70% dependent, Europe 46% dependent, the United States 17% dependent upon Gulf oil. Now, why did the Israeli elections outrage the Arabs? Let's get into that. Even though Benjamin Netanyahu won by only a narrow margin, he did so on fiery campaign rhetoric that flew directly in the face of the peace process that was put in place by slain former Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and has been continued by his successor, Shimon Peres. Netanyahu made it clear that he believes in a united Jerusalem, which will never again be a divided city, that he believes in continuing the settlements, and he's done it, that he believes in hanging on to the Golan Heights, and that he believes there will never be a Palestinian state that will divide and separate Israel, like on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And yet these are the four major objectives of the PLO and their Arab supporters throughout the entirety of the Islamic world. Repeatedly, spokespersons for the PLO, from Yasser Arafat to Hanna Ashoury, who is an outspoken female official in the PLO, make uncompromising statements about a Palestinian state with Jerusalem as its capital. Now we get back to talking about the pivotal place, the focal point of biblical prophecy, don't we? Jerusalem, and what Jesus said about an abomination of desolation standing in the holy place where it ought not, and about Jerusalem surrounded with armies. Now the PLO and the Arabs say those are the absolute preconditions to peace. They say there will never be peace with Israel until those goals are accomplished. And the language of the final communique that came from the very large Cairo summit was said to have been virtually written by Hafez Assad of Syria, and Assad was said to have managed to impose his views, this a quote now from Western news media, on the usually divided Arab world at that summit. Chillingly, the Arab communique clearly said that the region could be, and I quote, pushed back to violence, end quote, as a result of Netanyahu's victory, and called upon Turkey to reconsider its recent treaty with Israel that I've already mentioned. Immediately following Netanyahu's narrow victory, many Arab states, along with the European Union, issued statements which clearly told Netanyahu everyone expected him to continue the peace process. Now, that was as if dozens of governments around the world expected Netanyahu to immediately abandon his entire platform, which had propelled him to victory in the first place, and to adopt the policies of the very government he had set about to defeat. From that time to this, he has been talking about peace with security. You may have seen his address before the American Congress. He spoke of the moral force of the United States. He said, his voice ringing with passion and emotion, "We want peace." But he said, "Peace is based upon security for all." And he spoke of Israeli citizens who have been subjected to more terrorist attacks, he said, in the past 3 years than in the previous 10. He said to allow states in the region, such as Iraq and Iran, to become nuclearized would mean catastrophe for Israel and for the whole world. He said that before the U.S. Congress. And he said, his voice in a fervor of emotion, "Time is running out." He said, "We have to act." His speech flatly told all Arab states that the concept of trading land for peace, so far as he and his new government is concerned, is dead. Now, what do you think that means of the chances for peace in the region in the next few months or the next few years? I mean, if the entire concept of trading land for peace is the entire platform of the Arabs and what the PLO and everybody in the region is demanding, but if the Israeli government is saying absolutely no, not one inch, not one inch, that's what Teddy Kollek said to me over and over again one night when I was at a reception in his honor in Jerusalem and asked him whether or not they would ever be willing to allow the eastern city or the old city of Jerusalem to become the capital of a Palestinian state. He said it would never again be a divided city. He said they would never give up one inch. You're talking here of utter implacability, intractability, the proverbial immovable object and the irresistible force. You're talking here of inevitable war. Now, that statement, of course, infuriated Yasser Arafat and all the other Arab states, particularly Syria, and we will see eventually what comes to pass. This eruption, it is really an anomaly, this crazy thing that happened in the Kurdish area of northern Iraq, doesn't directly relate to what I'm talking about now with regard to the Saudi government and Saudi-American relations, or to Israel and the future of the state of Israel, surrounded by Islamic Arab states that would like to see all of the Jews driven into the sea, in other words, exterminated. But isn't it amazing how quickly it could widen? Because the United States immediately retaliates with cruise missiles and the entire world jumps into the fray with all kinds of opinions and all kinds of warnings, issuing all kinds of different news releases and communiques. And suddenly everybody's got something to say. You know, after Benjamin Netanyahu spoke to the Congress, a CNN correspondent that I heard moments later said this: he drove a stake through the heart of the concept of trading land for peace. So, we will see what happens as the Arabs react to all of this in the weeks and the months ahead. Is Egypt also, along with Iraq and Syria, which already have Scuds, arming itself with Scuds? News reports have said that Egypt is arming itself with Scuds. That is very frightening to Western observers, because they now know, and it's finally been admitted, even though I said it many, many years ago during the Gulf War, that Saddam Hussein had fitted chemical and biological warheads to his Scuds, and he had actually ordered them fired, but forward battlefield commanders did not obey the orders. Not only did he possess them, but he had deployed them in forward areas. Had the Israelis entered the war, the tenuous coalition of various Arab countries would have disintegrated immediately. Hussein knew full well the reluctance of Arabs to fight against fellow Arabs, even if Kuwaitis and some Saudis were furious over his brutal occupation of Kuwait. Today, there are claims by dozens of veterans organizations in the United States that when the U.S. forces blew up forward ammunition dumps, chemical and biological warheads exploded, sent clouds of poison gas and biological agents high into the atmosphere, and that the blowback effect, the drifting of the upper stratosphere, and the particles coming down actually caused dramatic illness among some veterans of the war in the Gulf. Initially, when U.S. veterans complained of strange illnesses, the Pentagon denied they could have been caused by blowing up chemical or biological weapons. But on June 21, 1996, the Pentagon suddenly announced they now had evidence that one Iraqi bunker north of Kuwait had been blown up by U.S. armed forces and that it had contained mustard gas and nerve gas. The United States News and World Report, in its July 8, 1996 issue, reported that two Army paratroopers and combat engineers who had been in top physical condition and had always scored in the top 1% of their fitness tests were now in very bad shape. The men are named Brian Martin and Chris Tullius. And the article said now Martin can't walk around the block without getting weak. He has chronic diarrhea, insomnia, and headaches, and he gets lost if he drives more than 3 miles from his home. Tullius's problems are mainly gastrointestinal. After he began vomiting blood, he had to have 9 corrective surgeries. Thousands of Gulf War veterans have complained of many illnesses. Some believe the anti-nerve gas pills they took prior to the campaign might have caused their problems. Recently, William Marcus, a senior science advisor at the Environmental Protection Agency, testified at a congressional hearing that several kinds of cancer, cancer of the brain, of the nervous system, for example, are 7 to 14 times higher among Gulf War veterans than among the general population. All in all, there is ample evidence that Saddam Hussein possessed chemical and biological weapons and, contrary to media reports during the Gulf War, that he had the technology to affix them to the warheads of his Scuds. Why am I mentioning this? Well, I think it's obvious. Saddam Hussein fired Scuds at Israel. Let me skip ahead and give you a quick scenario. What would bring about the building of a third temple in Jerusalem? A. Massive loss of life. Massive setbacks against Israel in a renewed war in the Middle East might finally just lead any Israeli government or the Israeli populaces that might rise up against a government to forget their kindly treatment of the Islamic mosques there on the Dome of the Rock, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, there on the mount that is the Temple Mount, Mount Moriah as it's called. And you might see big bulldozers in there pushing the rubble out of the way after large charges of dynamite have been set in those mosques, and the Jews might be busily paving the way for the building of a temple. If a massive national repentance of some sort, meaning saying, look, we were captured and we were taken to Babylon. The temple was destroyed and we have been a dispersed people. We have been the world's most persecuted people. Now here we are once again looking at the potential of a Holocaust just like in Hitler's Germany and in Central and Eastern Europe during World War II. And I'm telling you, in no uncertain terms, that the technology does exist and is possessed by Saddam Hussein, probably by Syria, possibly by Egypt, that could rain chemical and biological agents down on Tel Aviv and major population centers of Israel. And if that were to occur, you know. And I'm not talking about the Bible when I say this. I'm talking about geopolitics. You know that a major war on that scale in the Middle East would directly and immediately involve the United States of America. I mean, if a little incursion in Erbil by Saddam Hussein at the invitation of some of his own Kurds involves the United States immediately, risking all of this tension between its coalition allies, what do you think would happen if a massive Scud attack were to be mounted perhaps by combined Arab forces against Israel? Now, Netanyahu was obviously stung by Egypt's position at the Cairo Arab Summit. He said, I'd like to deepen and expand the peace between us. This is why I was particularly disappointed in the posture that Egypt undertook vis-a-vis the Cairo summit. I would hope that this is a temporary phase and that they would go back to the pattern of genuine peacemaking and genuine good neighborliness that has characterized our relationship in previous years. But Netanyahu knows a lot more than he revealed. Because as Arab leaders were convening in Cairo, the Washington Times released an article that cited a CIA report claiming North Korea had recently sent several large shipments of advanced Scud missile materials and that production of short-range missiles would begin in Egypt soon. The report was dismissed by Egyptian officials as being a ploy from certain quarters in Washington who, quote, did not want this summit to take place. Well, why would the CIA make it up? A managing editor of the semi-official newspaper, Vorontsov Alaram, in Cairo, said, this, that is the Times article about Scuds being manufactured in Egypt, can lead the region into a negative attitude toward the role of the U.S. in the Middle East peace process. Don't you doubt for one moment that Israel's famous intelligence agency, the Mossad, is unaware of such shipments. Because they do share intelligence with the CIA. Now, for many, many years, I have been saying on my telecasts, and before that, in thousands of radio broadcasts, and in many, many of our publications, booklets, and of course, 20th Century Watch, watch the Middle East, watch Jerusalem. In special columns within that publication, we continually updated our readers on little-known negotiations between Israel and the Vatican, have revealed how discussions have taken place concerning Jerusalem and its holy places becoming like a second Vatican under the jurisdiction of the Pope in Rome. Because of the clear meaning of the prophecies of Jesus Christ and Daniel concerning Jerusalem, it's natural that we would watch all developments in the region that might lead to the following events. Now, here they are. Listen carefully. One, some major events, as I've mentioned, such as massive loss of life as a result of Scud attacks with chemical and or biological weapons, would galvanize the Israeli government and the population to begin the building of a temple in Jerusalem. That would put the holy place, spoken of by Jesus Christ, right there, in situ, on site, in place. Two, watch to see whether the Arab mosques that now stand on the Temple Mount, the famed Dome of the Rock, and the Al-Aqsa mosques would be destroyed, or whether a temple would be built immediately adjacent to them, leaving them in place and not destroying them. Three, watch for the emergence of a powerful military and political leader among the Arab nations that begins to unite some of them together, perhaps the leader of Egypt, who would fulfill the prophetic role of the prophesied king of the south of Daniel 11, verses 40 to 45. Who is going to push at a king of the north that I believe is the beast power of Central Europe, who is then going to respond by moving into the Middle East, probably under the guise of saving the remainder of the Israeli population, probably as a peacekeeping force, probably coming in there to actually halt a war which might widen into a nuclear bomb World War III. Fourth, watch for the setting up of what is called the Abomination of Desolation in the Holy Place. That Abomination of Desolation is no longer going to be, as it was in the days of Antiochus Epiphanes, a stone idol. It's not going to be a boar's head or Roman standards. It's going to be in the form of the prophesied false prophet, who is the Antichrist, the man of sin, spoken of in 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter. Watch, then, for the setting up of the Abomination of Desolation in the holy place where it ought not, as Jesus himself warned in Matthew 24:15. Now, the holy place seems to indicate a temple, because when Christ said that, the temple was in place, and all those who heard him had to do was turn their heads, and there it was in the distance. If that is not required to fulfill the biblical prophecy, there could be a symbolic cornerstone that could be laid. There could be a temporary building built. There could be like a pavilion of some sort, even a tent-like affair that could be set up over a dedicated cornerstone. That would be all that is required, because I do not know perfectly to the last little detail exactly when, where, how, whether a temple will be built. For me to insist upon that when a cornerstone or a portion of it or even discovering some artifact from the ancient temple might lead toward its sanctification among the Jewish people as the most important holy site in the Jewish religion would satisfy Jesus' prophecy. Fifth, watch for the emergence of the beast power, a political military dictator who will form a 10-nation coalition that will intervene in the Middle East, occupying many countries, including Israel and Egypt, as you read in Daniel 11:40-44. Jesus Christ of Nazareth said we would be living in a time of wars and rumors of wars. But he said, "See that you be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines, and there are, and pestilences, and there are, and earthquakes in diverse places, and there are. All these," he says, "are the beginning of sorrows." He said in verse 14, "This gospel of the kingdom," the word gospel means good news. It's always darkest just before the dawn. I know that much of what happens in this world is bad news. I feel it. It hits me hard. I hate it. It absolutely is depressing when you look at it. It gets you down if you let it, because you hate to see the terrible suffering and the loss of human life. You hate to see the wastage of millions, hundreds of millions, and billions of dollars that could go for far more noble things, such as education and protection for our children. But nevertheless, Jesus Christ of Nazareth said that the good news of the kingdom will be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. And he also said, as I've emphasized recently, when all these things begin to come to pass, and some of these things are no doubt beginning, he said, "Then lift up your heads, for you know your redemption draweth nigh." There's going to be a lot of trauma, a lot of trial, before we see the light at the end of the tunnel. There's going to be a lot of warfare, a lot of loss of life, a lot of incredible events geopolitically in the Middle East and elsewhere in the world before all this comes to pass. Jesus led directly from the statement that the gospel of the kingdom would be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come, to say, "When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation stand in the holy place," he says, "then let them which Judea flee into the mountains." And he went on to say in verse 21 and 2, "And except those days should be shortened," and that means cut short by God's divine intervention, "there should no flesh be saved." And Moffat's version adds, obviously, the implication there, the word alive, because it's not talking about spiritual salvation, it's talking about flesh being saved alive. But he says, "For the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened or cut short." Now, right now, as you're hearing this tape, many nations possess weapons of such awesome destructive power that all mankind could be killed. There are enough nuclear weapons distributed in the hands of enough nations to more than obliterate all of humankind about 20 times over. There are horrifying weapons such as biological agents, chemical agents, in the hands of many, many nations. Those weird terrorists in Japan that released deadly sarin nerve gas in crowded Tokyo subways actually sent people over into Central Africa when the Ebola virus broke out, because they wanted to obtain it and bring back a culture to Japan. That is how insane some of these people are. And as you'll read in that booklet that I've mentioned a couple of times on this tape, of the Great Tribulation Is It About to Happen, you will read the details about how many tons of biological agents possessed by Iraq were never found by UN investigators following the Gulf War, and they still have not been found. Now, immediately following Daniel's description of this invasion of Israel and Egypt by the King of the North, that I believe is the beast power, he says, and I quote, "At that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even at that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book." Good news at the end of it, horrible news at the beginning of it. a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, to that same time, is the identical time that Jesus described as a time without precedent, without parallel in the entire history of the world. That means global warfare. It means the entire human family involved. It means hundreds of nations involved. It is a time that Jesus Christ described as a time of global catastrophe greater than any other time in all of human history. In spite of the fact that so many tens of millions died in Russia alone, that so many millions upon millions died all over Europe and in many far-flung parts of the world, in Japan, and all over the world during World War II, this great impending global catastrophe will be far greater than any other time in all of human history. It's nothing short of a nuclear, chemical, biological World War III in which countless millions are going to die. I don't want my children and my grandchildren to be involved. I don't want them to have to suffer that. I don't want those who are hearing my voice. I don't want the members of any of these various churches and groups. Well, I can go on and say that I don't want the citizens of Tyler, Texas, of Smith County, of the state of Texas, or of the United States of America, or Canada, or any other nation. And that includes India and Bangladesh. I don't want the countless millions of nations all over the world to have to suffer such incredible things. And yet, as you look at the maelstrom of hatred, at the vortex of violence, at the sputtering short fuse on the bomb that is the Middle East, you and I both know that in any moment of any day, you could wake up any morning, just as you did the other day when you found out Saddam Hussein had sent his army up into Erbil, and just as you did about the next day or so when you found out the United States had launched missiles and had slammed into all kinds of targets, killing people, maiming people in Iraq. So you could wake up any morning now and find out that there's been a massive attack against Israel. You could find out that war is breaking out elsewhere in the Middle East, or has broken out between North and South Korea, has broken out between China and Taiwan, has broken out somewhere in the world. In each case, the prophecy of Jesus Christ in Matthew 24 and the prophecies of Daniel in Daniel 11 and 12 point to the triggering events which immediately precede the Great Tribulation, which eventually is going to include the martyrdom, the actual murder of people who stand for the truth of God and the gospel of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, and who are willing to give their lives for it. Because Jesus Christ said the time is going to come when they that killed you will think they do God a service, and if they have persecuted me, they will persecute you. And he shows that the saints who live in the end time loved not their lives unto the death. And he shows that the end time church would be a straggling, small, scattered, remnant church who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. And he also says, when he, that is this evil power, has had the power to divide the holy people, when the power of the holy people has been scattered, then all these things are going to take place. I believe we're getting very, very close. And I believe that we all ought to be very, very thankful that Jesus Christ of Nazareth says in Luke 21:28, when these things, as horrifying as they are, as unthinkable as they are, begin to come to pass, then look up and lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. He also said this to his disciples. I know that some of them, he predicted and prophesied, were going to be martyred. To Peter, he said, Peter, they're going to take you where you would not. Hands are going to be laid upon you. You're going to be taken where you wish they wouldn't. He said to John, what is it to you if this other disciple remains until I come? And sure enough, Peter was viciously martyred. Tradition says he was crucified upside down. And John lived to a ripe old age. So that shows that some of them, even in that generation, were martyred, and others of them were allowed to live out their lives. So Jesus said, Luke 21:17, but there shall not an hair of your head perish. But he commands us, Luke 21:36, watch you therefore, and pray always. And there's the important part. Watch, be alert, be informed, be aware, be concerned, be involved. But especially, pray always that you might be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass, and to stand before the Son of Man. He warns in Luke 21:34 and 35, take heed to yourselves, lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with surfeiting, that means excesses, and drunkenness, and the cares of this life, and they are many, and they are crushing, and they are burdensome. They get us down. They depress us. They get us so frantic sometimes we don't know what to do. The cares of this life can come upon us like gigantic burdens, like a man staggering under a crushing load that he cannot even begin to lift. But he says, take heed to yourself, lest all of these things, including the cares of this life, cause that day to come upon you unaware. For as a snare it shall come on them that dwell on the face of the whole earth. Now once again, violence and war has broken out in the Middle East. And once again, our attention is focused on this most strategic part of the entirety of the world. I don't think I have to tell those of you who have been watching my television program or reading our literature very long that I believe with all of my being and all of my heart in the prophecies of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, in the prophecies of the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation. And with me, it is not some weird religious scenario at all. It is looking at plain world events that I read of in my weekly news magazines, that I see on nightly television, that I read of in newspapers. It is what is happening. It is what is going on. It is what is taking place. I'm not looking into crystal balls or tarot cards. I'm looking at world news because Jesus Christ of Nazareth says, watch. I'll conclude by reminding you the Apostle Paul wrote in 1 Thessalonians 5, 1-6, of the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I write unto you, for yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. For when they shall say, peace and safety, I will interject, listen to the statements of Netanyahu and Yasser Arafat. Listen to the statements of world politicians. Listen to the statements of government. We want peace. We want security. We want tranquility. We want peace. Let's have peace. And the Bible says, when they shall say, peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. But you, brethren, are not in darkness that that day should overtake you as a thief. You are the children of the light and the children of the day. We are not of the night nor of the darkness. Those of you listening to this tape represent a rare breed. You're different people. I'm not trying to say that you ought to be vain about that. You should be grateful. You should be humbly thankful to God that you are. But you're very different. Let me tell you why you're different. Because the vast majority of people all around you know virtually nothing of the things that I have talked about in this tape. They're not alert, they're not aware, they're not involved, they're not concerned. They don't have a grasp of world history, they don't have a grasp of geopolitics, they do not have a grasp of all of these situations, they are not able to put them together in the correct perspective and to view it in the light of biblical prophecy, and to know how close we are to the time of the end. Let me further speculate that there is a reason why you are a different kind of person, because I will also tell you that Almighty God knows your first name. He knows your address. He knows the thoughts of your heart. Could it be that Almighty God Himself is calling you? Could it be that all of this is not merely an accident? Could it be that you are interested, that your curiosity has been aroused, that your interest has been piqued, not because you're merely curious, not because it's something you just want to know, but because there's something far deeper that has to do with survival? that has to do with your life and everyone you love, your children, your family, your grandchildren? And could it be that you're concerned because you know, as I do, that we are living in very, very dangerous times, and that we are indeed living in the time just before, if not already just barely into, the great tribulation spoken of by Jesus Christ of Nazareth, our Savior? The Apostle Paul said, "You are children of the light and the children of the day. We are not of the night nor of darkness. Therefore, let us not sleep as do others," that is, to be spiritually asleep and be oblivious to conditions all around us, "but let us watch and be sober." I do what I do because I believe I must. I am writing the booklets that I am writing as fast and as furiously as I know how to write them, and the magazine articles as fast as I know how to write them, and doing these tapes at the broadcast studio and doing the television programs because I don't know how to do anything else, because I feel a very vital commission. I feel an incredible burden to do so. I feel a great and a massive responsibility to do so. And I'm doing so because I believe Almighty God not only wants me to, but I believe Almighty God would really take me to task, and that I would have an awful lot to answer for if I do not. I could not have been that sergeant on the top of that building, seeing that big oil tanker drive up there and men furtively scurry away and jump in a car and flee into the night, and just sit there and break out my lunch package and have a snack. I would have had to have done what he did, which is to go story by story through that building, banging and pounding on doors and saying, "Look out! It's a bomb! A bomb!" I am telling you all of these things that I'm telling you in this tape because I believe them down to the marrow of my bone. You know that you receive this tape free of charge. You know that you receive the booklets and all of the things that we send out absolutely free of charge. And if you don't know, I'll tell you right now, I would not be able to charge for the materials we send out because Jesus said, "Freely you have received, freely give." We give of the truth of God and the gospel of Jesus Christ and the witness and warning message and the work of the watchman to warn people of what is ahead cheerfully and freely, and we do so only to the degree that Almighty God, not us, not through coercion, not through psychology, not through some clever little method of getting people to get on board and to get with the program and become part of what we're doing, but waiting for the eternal Creator God to put it into the minds and the hearts of the people that He is using to join with us in the work of the watchman and the work of witness and warning and preaching the good news, the best news you and I could ever hear, that Jesus Christ of Nazareth is going to stand on this earth, that He is coming back at the conclusion of these events. He is coming back to save humanity at a time when, if He did not intervene, there wouldn't be a man, woman, or a child, or a little precious girl like my little granddaughter left standing alive on the face of this earth. That is the good news. It's my very life. It's what I am part of. It's what I do because I don't know what else to do. And I hope Almighty God is dealing with you and that you somehow will open your heart and decide that you're going to have a part in doing God's work as well.
You have heard Garnered Chad Armstrong.